Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files and listen on your phone or personal computer. And when you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening. Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created WebSeed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery, and our Surthrival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com. Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com.
listening to Survival and Beyond, and I'm your host, Ed Corcoran. And we're broadcasting to you from our family of networks now. I'm happy to announce that Survival and Beyond is now being broadcast on the Free America Now network. And real happy to be talking to the folks out there, as well as all of my regular listeners on the Natural News Radio Network and the Prepper Podcast Radio Network. So, just happy to get the word out and broaden our reach and, you know, hopefully help out more people. I'll tell you, I'm still waiting for spring to arrive here up in the North Country, up here in the Free State. I hate to complain about the weather, you know, but geez, it's been raining here for about a week and a half, and it's cold. You know, it's June. It's supposed to be like in the 70s at least. You know, the high 70s, and now it's been rancid cold out here. If that's even, that's a great descriptive, rancid cold. And just waiting for some sunshine. I actually asked one of my neighbors, I said, hey, does it ever get sunny here for more than like a day or two in a row? You know? And but it's rainy. And one great thing about it though, is that the springtime, all the animals are starting to come out. You know, we got wild turkey up here. Every morning I see a rafter a raft of wild turkeys. That's what it is. It's a raft. And, four or five of them at a time. And boy, come around Thanksgiving time, you know, I don't know. I'm going to have to find out what the ordinance is on that, but, on turkey hunting, here on the mountain. But, also I've seen fox, just the other day, on a road not too far from my house, I saw a black bear cross right in front of me. You know, it's great. We get chipmunks. I've heard there's a chipmunk explosion. Actually, there's too many chipmunks. But we got fisher cats up here. Haven't seen a fisher cat yet, but they're around. And also here, there's moose up here on the mountain too. You know, so it's really cool. It's invigorating and everything. Nonetheless, the springtime is, you know, getting that green energy going. It's really been bringing up my spirits, and just wish it would get warm. Wish it would get warm and stop raining. You know, it's like treacherous hiking here after it's been raining for a long time, because it's just the mud is slick and it's just like being on ice. So it takes a couple of days for it to dry out, and then you can go hiking up the mountain. But you can do it in the mud, I guess, but you just have to be. It's just a pain in the butt. You know, it's just not enjoyable. So hopefully it'll dry out and I can start getting some more hiking in, because that's it. Got to get that exercise. You know, I get depressed if I don't get the exercise, and most of you folks, you know, I'm sedentary. My occupation, what I do, you know, requires that I spend a lot of time at a desk or at a computer. And, so, you know, you got to get that exercise. Otherwise, you know, you get run down, you get, you know, feeling down, you know, the emotional thing. So, you know, if you're in the same situation and you're not, you know, really getting out too much, and you kind of have a sedentary job or what have you, you know, just try to make an effort to get out for at least a half an hour, get your heart rate up, you know, every day, hopefully, you know, more than that. That's something that's been on my mind. I've been thinking about it a lot. So I guess that's why it's coming out now. But, you know, it's a good message. It's a good message to, you know, fitness is very important for survival. If you're out of shape, boy, you know, and you're getting winded from, you know, walking a few hundred feet or whatever, then, you know, you're going to be in trouble, you know. So fitness is a great thing. And, you know, as I'm getting more into that, I'm talking to more fitness experts right now, because I do think that's, you know, it's incredibly important. I want to bring some more fitness information to Survival and Beyond and to the website and everything. And if you haven't checked out the website, it's at survivalandbeyond.net. And there's all kinds of cool stuff. I'm working on that site constantly, posting news and downloads and survival guides and videos and all kinds of stuff. So, you know, it changes every day. So, you know, you want to check back often. And sign up for the newsletter. That would be cool. I have a newsletter, and you know, we're getting signups and everything. But I know there's a whole lot more people visiting the site than are signing up for the newsletter. The site traffic has just been phenomenal. I've been surprised by how great the traffic has been going. But yeah, it's been doing great, and I appreciate it, and I just want to give my gratitude to all you folks out there who are coming to the website and checking it out and enjoying the information that's on there. And you know, gratitude is very important, and I'm always grateful for my readers and my listeners. And you know, so anyway, on to a little bit of a news thing. Well, before I start off, I want to tell you, boy, I've got a big show for you tonight. I've got two guests tonight, and my first guest is Dan Johnson. And Dan Johnson founded the group PANDA, which is People Against NDAA, or the National Defense Authorization Act. And it's one of the fastest growing liberty groups out there. You know, there's already over 40 councils, and it's all over the country. It's nationwide. And Dan's the amazing thing about it is Dan is only 18 years old. And it's just really inspiring to see, you know, somebody his age, you know, like usually you tend to think of young people as like, you know, they're clueless and, you know, they don't care about anything. And, you know, then they're asleep. They're sheeple, you know, and they don't know what's going on. But, it's always gratifying to see, like, you know, like Ron Paul followers is a really strong contingency among college students and or college age, students and everything. And so to see, a guy like Dan, you know, step up. And really, you know, do something to make a difference to get active, you know, it's like, I applaud that. So it's going to be great talking to him. And, also we have Mike Brown on the show, and, a lot of people, he's really well known in the alternative energy, realm. And Mike Brown is one of the last manufacturers or the last manufacturers of steam engines. And boy, you ought to see these things. They're freaking cool. And steam engines make a lot of sense in a survival situation. If the grid goes down, you know, a lot of people, you know, talk about solar or wind turbines or whatnot. It's like none of them can hold a candle to steam power. And it's something that you never hear anybody talking about. You hear a lot of people talk about biodiesel and, you know, about all those other things that I mentioned earlier. And you don't hear anybody talking about steam engines. We, you know, think of it as a quaint, you know, throwback, you know, 19th century technology or whatever. But you know what? We might have to go back to that, you know, if the grid goes down and it's down out for good, you know, or at least for the next 10 or 20 years, you know, that's where we're going to be. We're going to, you know, kind of be, I don't think it'd be quite as bad as like full on, you know, 19th century living. But it's going to get to like where steam power is going to be very much in demand. So we're going to have him on the show. And something I didn't know about Mike, I mean, I knew that he was a legal expert and a constitutional scholar, but I didn't realize how deep his background really is. I think he has like over 26 years experience as a paralegal, and he's been involved in a lot of high profile court cases and everything. He's got a lot of information about that. We didn't have a whole lot of time to get into that. We did, you know, brush over it at the end, and definitely want to have him back on the show to get more into, you know, your civil law and your rights and things like that, and how to protect them, and you know how to function in the legal system. And he teaches people how to handle their own cases and whatnot. So he's a fascinating guy, and so he's coming up as well. Now I'll get to the piece of news that, you know, and this is, I'm really happy to report this. I was really happy when I found this piece of information here, you know, because I always, you know, I kind of hate having to come on the show and be all like doom and gloom and, you know, on the New World Order and, you know, and the government and, you know, Obama executive orders and, you know, and all that. And this piece really put a smile on my face. This piece of news right here is really showing that people are waking up. They're waking up to the globalist agenda, and states are starting to do something about it. And you know, and that's really what needs to happen. You know, like even with the NDAA and all this other stuff, I mean, nothing's going to happen on a federal level. You know, but there's no federal judge that has the authority to tell the president what to do. And you know, so it's up to the states to step up, and it's up to the communities and the towns and the counties to step up, and the sheriffs, you know, all you constitutional sheriffs out there, you know, it's like my hat's off to you. But anyway, to get to the point, which I'm sure you're all dying for me to do, this is about the state of Alabama passing legislation to block Agenda 21 protocols. And for those of you who don't know what Agenda 21 is, that's basically the United Nations plan to basically come in and tell us what to do with our own land under the guise of sustainable development. They've got all these non-governmental organizations and foreign-owned organizations like ICLEI that come in. They set up shop in every single county in the United States, or at least that's the way it was. There are now counties that are rejecting these sustainable development groups and getting them out of their counties and everything. But at one time, and not too long ago, there wasn't a single county that didn't have some kind of green initiative, environmental, you know, smart growth, sustainable development organization, NGO, coming in and trying to tell them what's what. And the overall plan of Agenda 21 is to deny us resources to our natural, denies access to our natural resources. And all of this is being incorporated through executive orders and through legislation. You know, all these little sneaky bills that get passed that nobody's paying attention to, or like the Rural Council executive order, you know, anytime you hear about an executive order being signed, that's bad news. And Obama is, if not, he's probably not the most executive order signingist president ever, but he's pretty darn close. And so all of these, all this legislation is being passed and executive orders being signed that is designed to restrict access to natural resources. What they ultimately want to do, the United Nations plan, you can look this up. It's not a conspiracy theory. Go on the UN website, you know, UN.org, United, and also I think you can get there by UnitedNations.org. But the Agenda 21 is all spelled out. And they also want to affect our food production. They want to affect consumption. Basically, they want to depopulate the planet. They want to bring about a world government. That's what the United Nations was set up to do. I mean, even FDR admitted it after World War II. It's like, oh, now we got the United Nations that's going to usher in an age of world government. They're meant to be a world governing body. And so what they're doing is they want to round people up, get us out of rural areas. Let the farms be taken over by Monsanto because they know what's best for us, and force people to live in urban human habitation zones. Take their cars away. They don't want anybody driving cars because of the phony global warming hoax. You know, everybody, and it's all going to be under the guise of green, environmentally responsible, you know, sustainable development. You know, it's like I'm all for sustainability. You know, but this is using the environment in order to make us slaves. And I've ranted about this on my show on a number of different occasions. It's, you know, you've heard me talk about this. So anyway, in a nutshell, that's Agenda 21. And they want to take our sovereignty away. They want to take away our rights to private property. That's their ultimate goal, really. Take away abolish private property rights. And you know, they've got control of us, and they control our food, everything else. So Alabama is the first state to stand up to this nonsense, and they passed legislation SB 477, and I want to read this is an article that's from the New American, and I wanted to read parts of it. You know, there's not a whole lot of time. We got a really full show, but I wanted to go over this because this is really inspiring. It's really, you know, hopeful. And, you know, virtually no mention of this is made in the mainstream media, of course. You know, anytime a state stands up for itself, exercises its 10th Amendment rights, you don't hear about it in the mainstream media because they don't want us to realize that the states have rights and there is a 10th Amendment. But the article reads, and I'm just going to read excerpts from, I'm not going to read the entire article, just some of the highlights that I picked out before I started the show. It says, the people of Alabama, acting through their elected representatives, not UN bureaucrats, have the authority to develop the state's environmental and development policies. The official synopsis of the law explains, therefore, infringements on property rights of citizens linked to any other international law or ancillary plan of action that contravenes the Constitution of the United States or the Constitution of the State of Alabama are also prohibited under the new measure. So what it means is, you know, under the Constitution, we do not allow foreign entities to come and dictate to us, you know, so putting it succinctly. And this is Alabama standing up and you know, standing on that point. The article continues, of course, as the law points out, the UN has enlisted a broad array of non-governmental and intergovernmental organizations in its effort to foist Agenda 21 on the world. Most notably, a Germany-based group called ICLEI, formerly known as the International Council of Local Environmental Initiatives. But the new measure takes direct aim at the problem, too. The state of Alabama and all political subdivisions may not enter into any agreement, expand any sum of money, or receive funds, contracting services, or giving financial aid to or from any such entities as defined in Agenda 21 documents. This bill that would bar the state from taking over private property without due process is intended to shelter Alabamians from the United Nations Agenda 21, a sustainable development initiative that some conservatives see as a precursor for the creation of a world government, explained Alabama GOP Executive Director T.J. Maloney. See, people are waking up. You know, people in state politics are waking up to the globalist agenda, you know, and there's proof positive right there. The Republican National Committee adopted a resolution earlier this year blasting the global scheme and urging policymakers to oppose it, and state parties have followed suit. Now, the governor of Alabama wasn't sure if he wanted to sign this to approve this this bill, because one of the things that one of the swords of Damocles that they hang over the heads of states, you know, who do not comply with this Agenda 21 protocol is that the government threatens to just pull their funding, pull whatever funding that the state's been receiving. And so, you know, Governor Bentley was originally hesitant to sign the bill, and it was directly it's speculative, but it's believed that it's directly related to his fear of loss of federal funding. You know, and this is what Ken Freeman, chairman of the Alabama-based group Alliance for Citizens' Rights, said: every time you take a dollar of federal money, there's strings attached. You know, and that's that should go without saying. You know, anything that the government doesn't do anything without strings attached or without an ulterior motive. And this is the Alliance for Citizens' Rights, and that's an organization that fought hard to ensure that the governor signed the bill into law. It seems that Agenda 21, and again, I'm quoting from the article again, it seems that Agenda 21 does actually bring people together in communities, just not in the way the UN had hoped for, remarked Justice Gilpin Green in a column for the conservative site Town Hall. Alabama House Bill 618, which is the Senate Bill 477, is a large step towards protecting Alabamians against UN meddling. It protects the due process rights of Alabamians. It keeps constitutional law above international law, noted Jason Baker, a Montgomery-based conservative pundit with The Examiner. Now this is what's really encouraging about it, you know, because what's going to happen now is, like, other states are going to take notice. You know, New Hampshire, my home state, my resident state, I guess I should say, has got a bill to ban Agenda 21 that sailed through the House and Senate, according to this article. And Arizona also tried to pass legislation, and I guess it died in the state house. It's not really clear. That doesn't really say in the article. I'm going to have to do a little more research in it to find out what happened in Arizona, because Arizona, you know, most of you folks listening know that, you know, I lived in Arizona for quite a while, and I consider that to be my home state, really. That's really where my heart is. And Arizona doesn't take no mess, you know. Arizona's not going to take any guff from the government, and they've stepped up on 10th Amendment issues before. And so I don't know exactly what happened or why this bill didn't it was approved overwhelmingly in the Senate, in the state Senate, but it died in the House for some reason. And I'll have to find out more about what's going on with that. And if any of you listeners know what's going on with the Arizona bill to defeat Agenda 21, then please let me know. Go to survivalandbeyond.net and you know, leave me a message, a comment. And if you have any other ideas for the show, for that matter, you know, if there's anybody any guests you'd like to hear on the show, or if you'd like to be a guest on the show or know somebody who would like to be a guest on Survival and Beyond, then, you know, by all means, come down to the website and come on down to the website, y'all. And you know, drop me a line. There's a comment or a contact page, and you can, you know, if you have any questions, any interaction, I love to hear from my listeners and readers. And so, you know, and even if it's critical, even if you know, there's anything I could be doing better, then, you know, just come on down, y'all, and let me know. Drop me a comment. But anyway, getting back to this bill. There's states are taking notice. Other states are starting to see what's going on. They're starting to smell what's cooking as far as the globalist agenda is going. And so that can't be anything but good. You know, people are waking up and states are starting to exercise their sovereignty. So, and reflected in the articles, local governments across America, under intense pressure from citizens and activist groups, are slowly awakening to what critics call the dangers of the UN scheme. Dozens of cities and counties have withdrawn from ICLEI in recent years, and as awareness continues to grow, that trend is expected to accelerate. Awesome, awesome. Production, education, consumption, individual rights, and even people's thoughts will be targeted under the global plan to create a so-called green economy. The UN admitted this. This is, you know, like I said, it's all spelled out. They're not hiding it, you know. It's not a big mysterious conspiracy theory. It's right out there. They're admitting this. And again, from the article with the tidal wave of opposition in America growing stronger every single day, analysts expect fierce U.S. opposition, if not from the Obama administration. Yeah, right. The Obama administration is completely compliant with all this Agenda 21. I mean, that's what the Rural Council was all about, the executive order that Obama signed not too long ago, which says that basically the federal government come in and decide, you know, what's to be done with our rural resources. And then, you know, that was followed by NDAA, and it was followed by the resources, the Defensive Resources Act. And, you know, it's a big power grab. It's being taken over. The federal government is just making sure that they're getting in every single crack and getting a foothold everywhere they can. And we've got to stop this. We got to wake up to this. We got to wake other people up to this, and not just not just, you know, bellyache and complain and holler about it, but, you know, actually do something. You know, become an activist. Do whatever you can. And that's about all the time we're going to have to take a quick break. And I'm really glad to bring you this news. It's good to bring good news for a change, and, you know, showing that the you know, state governments are starting to wake up. But we got to take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll be talking to Dan Johnson, founder of Panda. So just sit tight. We'll be right back.
Survival is not about the end of the world. It's not about a hypothetical plane crash or the latest violent storm. Survival is about the satisfaction of knowing you can take care of yourself and your family in any situation, anytime, anywhere. CampingSurvival.com was started in 1956. No, not the .com part, the survival part. CampingSurvival.com has over 17,000 urban, wilderness, and preparedness items. Supreme customer service, very low shipping, and no games. We look around to make sure we have the lowest prices. And CampingSurvival.com is 100% USMC veteran-owned. Don't base your survival on the latest spring-up-on-the-internet company. Do business with an authority on survival. CampingSurvival.com. Confidence born on preparation.
Those of you who listen to my show all the time, you always hear me talking about, you know, getting active, and if you know the truth and if you're awake, you know, to it's your duty to try to wake up as many people as possible, whether that's sending out emails or posting comments, or, you know, getting the word out on Facebook, or even starting your own website, you know, just get that information out there. You know, it's like there's not a single one of us that we can do without. You know, we need to really wake people up and wake them up fast and give them a fast and hard awakening. And my guest tonight has done just that. He started, he went so far as to start his own organization. And he saw something that just wasn't right about our Constitution, wasn't right about what America's all about. And he started his organization called PANDA, which is People Against the National Defense Act, and or against NDAA. And I'll tell you, folks, if you don't know what NDAA is, it's a law we got in this country now that allows basically the deterrent of any American citizen for no reason whatsoever, indefinitely, with no due process, no legal counsel, no judge, no jury, no trial, no nothing, indefinitely. And this is a police state, folks. This is what we're talking about when we say police state. And you know what? It's underreported in the mainstream media. Whatever little there is of it, people disregard because they don't see anything particularly wrong with it, I guess, or they're just too busy watching American Idol and playing with their Xbox to care about it too much. So, and, you know, one of the other things I always talk about, too, is it's always great to see young people getting involved in the liberty movement and young people getting out and waking people up, too. And our guest is classified out as a young person. He's 18 years old, and his name is Dan Johnson. And he was always interested in politics. He's a political science major at Bowling Green State University. And he's ranked among the top 30 impromptu speakers in the nation. So he formed his organization, PANDA, and that has now over 40 chapters in 23 states, and it's one of the fastest-growing liberty movements in the nation. So it's my pleasure to have you on the show, Dan. Welcome to Survival and Beyond.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on.
So you say that you started hearing things, or you know when you got interested, or when you started becoming aware. Tell us a little bit about what really woke you up to what was going on, because, like, you know, a lot of people your age, not you know, I don't mean this derogatorily or anything like that, but, you know, most people in their teens and 20s, they're pretty clueless and oblivious to politics and everything that's going on. What really got you going?
Well, my father had always been very libertarian-minded and telling me about the surveillance of Americans and the Patriot Act and things like that. But I'd kind of ignored everything he was saying until late November, when they were deliberating the NDAA in the Senate around Thanksgiving break. And I saw a video that someone posted on YouTube about it. I believe it was called 61 Senators Betrayed You Today. And I watched the video once and went, this is not America. This is something that would happen in China or Syria or North Korea. And I watched it again, and I think about the fifth time I watched the video, I started realizing that this was true, and this is the type of thing that is actually happening in America. And in the month and a half or so of research that I did after that, I really start. That was my awakening to the big machine that was taking over the American government, and that was the American government.
Yeah, it's a shadow government. And FEMA is part of it, and certainly the Department of Homeland Security. So when you and I don't understand why, I mean, it baffles me how when NDA, even in the mainstream media, what was reported, you know, people didn't bat an eye at it, you know, especially I thought when it was revealed that that language, that it does apply to American citizens, was actually removed and then deliberately put back in there again. You know, what do you think it is? Why do you think people just, why does anybody need to be woken up when something like this is you know, right in front of their faces?
Well, the mainstream media won't cover this type of thing with any depth at all, because any of you probably seen the papers where the Pentagon admits over and over again to paying off big media sources to talk about propaganda and to discuss the other topics that are going on besides the NDAA or anything that's going on through the Senate.
What's your experience and your interactions with people when do you find that people are responsive to this when you tell them this information, or do you think it's hard to convince them, or if they just think you're a kook?
I find if I keep it to the NDAA, a lot of people are very receptive to the information. I'd say about 90% of the people I've talked to will want more info on it and will want to look more into it if you can get them talking. There's a few people that obviously in anything that you do that will not be receptive to it. But I've found that a lot of people who aren't strictly supporting the president right now are very supportive of anything we're doing against this and are, quite frankly, blown away by this type of thing that's happening right in their backyard, right in the Washington, D.C.
You seem to be very successful at this, and you told me offline that your membership ranks are growing so fast that it's you can't even come up with a solid number at any moment. And so how is it? How did this start? How did you get mobilized with Panda and achieve the reach that you have?
Well, I got really upset and frustrated that they would pass the NDAA with such bipartisan numbers in Congress, and the president would dare sign something like this, that I did what I thought I could do at that point, which was I launched a YouTube video, just pictures and voiceover, and I also started up my long-dead Twitter account, A Second Opinion, and just started tweeting and spreading the word about it and learning what I could. And then at my college, I tried to get something started there. And basically, we got started through social media, through Twitter, through YouTube. Mm-hmm. And that is really what launched us into going anywhere, was the internet. Without the internet, I wouldn't be talking to you, that's for sure. And there'd be very few who even knew about the NDAA. So the internet has taken a huge role in our founding, as well as Ohio Oath Keepers and Young Americans for Liberty, the local chapter there, helped us out.
Right. The internet is a very powerful tool. That's something I tell my listeners all the time. You know, as much as you hear about internet privacy and, you know, with Facebook and all the data mining that's going on and how it's a liability to our privacy, and it is a liability to our privacy, but we can also use it to our advantage. And this is just a perfect example of that. So why don't you tell our listeners where they can find your website and what they will find at your website?
All right. Our website is a huge conglomerate of pretty much everything. It's located at peopleagainstndaa.com. Again, that's peopleagainstndaa.com. And they'll find quite a few things on there. I'll highlight a few of them. Number one, they will find the More Info page. This is very good for people who have friends and relatives who aren't quite certain that the NDAA is that bad. They can go to our More Info page and they can find things such as the basics for people who are easily shown things. And we also have 6 links worth of legal analysis with everything from Harvard, the law record, and all the way to the Young Turks YouTube broadcast and Joanne Mariner, who is a very big human rights activist, inspecting the NDAA on Justia, which is a respected law website. And also there, they'll find some cool stuff we found, which is some Liberty Beats. So these are songs that are written about the NDAA or against the NDAA. Anything from hip-hop all the way to, we're going to be adding a piano track, almost like a Coldplay, a piano and guitar from a top Canadian artist. And that'll be going up there. They'll also find video and resources such as counterterrorism documents released by the FBI and a bunch of different resources there. Also on there, they can find our Unite video, which is a very good video as an introduction to the NDAA to pretty much anyone. They can find the Get Involved page, obviously, where they can join up with the organization and help us do what we're doing. Liberty Candidates is another very cool place we put in place, and that is a database of all the candidates that have contacted us saying, hey, we're against the NDAA, we're running in our local states, our districts, and we'd like to be listed on your website so that people can go, all right, these people have taken a stance, and we'll vote them into office. And finally, you can find our network, which is a place that we have listed all of our public sponsors. There's a few behind-the-scenes sponsors we have as well. Media, which is just some articles and video written on us. Events, which is if anyone wants to know about an NDAA event going on, they can go to that page, and that'll have most, if not all, of them listed. And then finally, our donate page. We've run Panda off of $350 for the past 4 months, and we've grown from zero to 24 states. So we're a very frugal organization, but we're going to be actively seeking donations in the future, and they can also go there to do that.
That sounds great. It sounds like you got a ton of information on there. You're really getting active out there. Do you have any events coming up?
We don't have any events scheduled right now. We just got done with one. A constable in Pennsylvania, as far as legislative events, a constable in Pennsylvania just agreed to interpose against the federal government on the NDAA if they attempted to enforce it anywhere in Pennsylvania. Now, it's just one man. He has a lot of power on a constable position. He can't be everywhere at once, but it is a good start as far as that goes. The big event, the only other event we have coming up right now is an Oath Keepers conference I'll be speaking at on the 16th in Perrysburg, Ohio. We have that event coming up, but as far as legislatively, we're mostly getting our chapters off the ground right now.
Yeah, you know, as I've been reporting and you've been getting the word out about it through that article you've been sending around, Judge Kathleen Forrest smacked down the NDAA and called it unconstitutional. And, you know, the government is apparently above the Constitution because, you know, there's nothing, they're not budging an inch about it. And, you know, if we can't get results on the federal court level, then, you know, what other way is there? What is your plan to combat the NDAA?
As it was stated in that article, the Supreme Court and the court system has neither the power of the sword nor the purse, so they can't really enforce their rulings on the government. However, we're taking this to a local level and using the power of the county sheriff to protect the citizens from federal government encroachment, and he does have that power to say that he will not comply with unconstitutional law. So we're harnessing the power of the local level, the grassroots level, to defend against this instead of using the government, which has been dirt slow, number one, and number two, has decided that they will A, uphold it in the Congress, and B, ignore rulings in the judiciary.
That's really the only way that you can do it, because it's not going to, you know, obviously there's no there's no way around it on a federal level. So, and that's really where you need to go in any kind of cause anyway, is to get people motivated and get them active locally.
Yeah, we have a three-part strategy as far as that question to the point. And it's number one, we go into a city and we go into the legislature and we have them pass a bill that says not only is the NDAA illegal here, but it's also kidnapping. And we will charge the federal government with that. Secondly, this is the enforcement portion. You use the power of the county sheriff and you say, all right, he's going to sign a resolution that says, A, he will not comply with the federal government on the NDAA if they attempt to use it in his county, and B, he will interpose or get in the way if they attempt to use federal agents to go around his office. And then thirdly, we'll be developing in the near future a Android and iPhone smartphone app, and that'll be a network of citizen vigilance, which will allow them to take a picture or a video of a civil liberties incident. For example, the bunch of federal agents outside someone's house, a drone, anything of the sort, which will make the NDAA impossible to implement because they can send that with a description location directly to our servers as kind of a deterrent. Because the federal government, when they're doing operations like that, hates sunlight and hates media attention.
Yep, obviously. Wow, that sounds like a really great plan. You've got a lot using technology to your advantage there. Now, you mentioned the surveillance drones, and I know that there are some other issues that you're concerned about as well. And that's an issue that I just can't stop telling people about this. And again, another one of these things where you're just amazed that you really have to, you know, shake people and, you know, to get them to respond to something like this. The fact that there's been approved the use of 30,000 surveillance drones over the United States. And you've got, speaking of on a local level, I mean, there are local counties sheriff's departments and police departments who can't wait to start using drones for their own purposes as well. And there's been talk about them being armed with shotgun tasers, and you know, who knows, they're not going to stop there. You know, what's your whole take on the drone situation?
Well, I was looking at this bill it was yet to be passed when I was looking at it. It's FARA, as you know, the Federal Aviation Administration Reauthorization Act.
Mm-hmm.
And it was saying that it's going to authorize permits for 30,000 drones by 2020 and 7,500 by 2015. I'm looking at this and going, all right, so what are their reasons for this? And their number one reason was, and I quote, to find lost hikers.
I haven't heard that one.
Maybe I'm missing something, but you don't need 30,000 drones to find all 8 lost hikers we have every year.
Right.
Besides the fact that drones have a hard time seeing through forest.
Mm-hmm.
So
that's hilarious.
Yes. That was their reasoning, and I go, all right, so they're lying there, and started looking at the types of drones and where these drones would be located, and this is a invasion of privacy if there ever was one. I like Judge Napolitano's quote where he said, the first man to shoot down a drone will become an American hero.
Right.
It's starting to seem that way because, as you probably already know, the University of Colorado is getting at least 30. I don't know why they need 30, but apparently they're getting 30 drones. And before they even rolled out this program, apparently they were doing it covertly. Because I've talked to people in Baltimore, Maryland, talked to people in Tacoma, Washington, and I've talked to people in Rockport, Texas. And they were saying they all have drones there. And in Baltimore, they have weapon-carrying drones. They have predators.
Yeah, they have a drone program was launched in 20 states so far. This is unbelievable. I did not think when, you know, like I read the same information that you mentioned earlier, that this was going to be, you know, a project that draws out over several years. And I didn't expect this to be activated as quickly as it has been. I mean, already in 20 states, I mean, this is happening all over. They're not wasting any time. And the critics say, well, that's not a full implementation. Like, any implementation of it at all is unacceptable. I don't care if it's one. I don't care if they have one drone flying over the entire country. That's not acceptable to me.
Here's the big thing, the biggest thing that bothers me with drones is for now, they are operated by humans. We know that they can operate on their own.
Mm-hmm.
A drone has no qualms about killing an American citizen, has no qualms about following an American citizen. If you tell a United States Air Force pilot, you're going to drop a bomb in an American house, he's going to go, haha,
yeah,
no.
No way.
But if you tell a Predator drone that, does what it's told.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the fact that, and I don't know if you're aware of this, but I reported on Survival and Beyond on the website about there's a master list that Obama has complete control over. He tells, you know, he says who lives and who dies and who gets the drone, you know, who dies by drone attack, and there are American citizens on that list, you know. And these are, you know, being approved by humans, and this is being operated by humans, not to mention all the collateral damage that occurs, to use military parlance to describe the maiming and killing of children and civilians and, you know, bystanders and whatnot when they perform these drone attacks. The whole thing, there's nothing good about it. There's nothing that doesn't disgust me about this. So what else are you focusing a lot of your concern about in terms of, you know, the erosion of our liberties and the removal of our rights and the things that you've been seeing going on?
Well, we're obviously looking very closely at the NDAA because it is the head of the beast.
Sure.
But I'll be talking a little bit. I'll just touch on a few of the other things. Eventually, we're going to be releasing a video called The Pieces Are Coming Together. And we'll kind of outline, because I've seen the chess pieces moving into place with all of these different bills and programs and et cetera, that you really can't deny the fact that there's something big they're all going for.
Mm-hmm.
We'll look at H.R. 347. I'm not sure how familiar you are with the Anti-Protest Act, as it was called, but it passed unanimously in the Senate. You can't get those people to agree on what color they want to write their letters in. Yet they can pass this unanimously and quickly. People mm-hmm. keep telling me about the inefficiency of our Congress. Well, when they want to pass something like that, efficient as all get out. I think it took 30 days for H.R. 347 to go through both houses and get signed by the president. In a nutshell, it allows the president to issue Secret Service protection to anyone. And if you're in the proximity, which is not defined, unlike many other bills, if you're in the proximity of that person that this president now assigns Secret Service to via a letter, then you can be arrested for a felony. And if you have so much as a spoon in your pocket, because that can be considered a weapon if you look at our public schools,
mm-hmm.
if you have so much as a spoon in your pocket, that's a deadly weapon, and you can be thrown in jail for 10 years of federal felony.
Jeez. You know, that was fast. That did get approved quickly, because so quickly that this is something that's new to me, as a matter of fact, and I usually keep up on the legislation and the bills and whatnot are going through Congress. Yeah, they didn't want anybody to know about this, for sure.
And then talking about my next favorite, Viper Teams. How familiar are you with Viper Teams?
Viper Teams, yes. We need to keep the terrorists out of the high school proms and the shopping malls and, the football events, right?
Mm-hmm. They have been installing them on, the latest was buses in Houston, are mm-hmm. getting Viper Teams. Basically, they stand for Visual Intermodal Prevention Response Team, I believe. And it's the TSA, again, but they are exercising their transportation part of their transportation safety administration rather than just the airport security portion. And
right. They
are secretive teams. They're not allowed to share any information. There's plenty of videos on YouTube where people have asked them, what are you doing? How are you doing this?
Mm-hmm.
And they're very secretive about it. They don't tell anyone. But they're basically teams of untrained agents, untrained people that are performing the work of a fully trained FBI agent, and all they're doing is making life miserable for Americans with security checkpoints and things like that, especially on Tennessee highways. They've had those where you can just get pulled over and randomly searched.
Oh, yeah, and they give it a name like that, and so you think there's some crack squad of crime fighters or something, you know. But they're the same idiots that are molesting you in the airport. They just give them a costume, and there you are.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're familiar with the National Counterterrorism Center.
Oh, yeah.
They used to, when they were founded, and this kind of shows the progression of things and why it's so dangerous to have unarmed drones and why it's so dangerous to have the NDAA or things like that. The National Counterterrorism Center was founded just after 9/11, and when it was founded, they absolutely, positively could not hold any data or even search for any data on non-terrorist suspects. Not long after that, it was increased to, yes, you can search for data on non-terrorist suspects, but you have to delete it immediately if you find out that they're a non-terrorist.
Right.
Now, after that, they changed it to 90 days. You can hold non-terrorist information, terrorist suspect information, for 90 days. And this is social network. This is Twitter feeds.
Mm-hmm.
This is Facebook walls. This is things like that. Now, they can hold it for 5 years. Non-terrorist suspects, they can hold it for 5 years. And they're building a data center in Utah that I'm sure you're aware of to do just that. It holds 1 yottabyte of data. To give you and your listeners an idea of what a yottabyte of data is, the entire traffic of the internet of the world for 1 year is 1,000 times smaller than a yottabyte.
Yep, that's a lot of info. Yeah, the thing too is that there's no definition of, you know, what a terrorist suspect is. You know, we can be declared a terrorist suspect, you know, by simply showing, you know, too much interest in protecting our privacy, or, you know, buying things with cash and not using credit cards.
Right. And I'd like to point out the belligerent act in the NDAA. If you commit a belligerent act against the United States or coalition partners, neither belligerent act or coalition partners is defined. I mean, at this point, they could define a coalition partner as a white van and terrorism as spraying it with red paint. The folks at belligerentact.org have done a really good job of pointing out the fault in having a belligerent act as a terrorist, a reason to be suspect of terrorism. But I'd like to also point out some of the more hilarious ones I've seen are for martial arts schools. If you introduce hand-to-hand combat, you're a terrorist suspect in a martial arts situation. Please help me understand that. If you travel an illogical distance,
you're a terrorist.
I'm not sure. 2 feet? When I'm lazy.
Yeah, it's absolutely, the language that it's written in is just, you know, absolutely vague. And any, you know, really any of this, you know, political legalese is intentionally vague and obfuscated, and that's the purpose of legal language. But, you know, and what did an illogical amount of travel, what did you call it? How was it termed?
If you travel an illogical distance.
Yep. Well, yeah, there's all kinds of things, and I'm glad you're out there getting people aware of this. I'm, you know, and you're really an example. You're serving as a powerful example for other people your age, as well as people my age and people in general, Americans in general. I mean, there is something you can do about it. You know, instead of just complaining or saying, oh, you know, shrugging your shoulders and saying, oh, you know, you're only one person and everything. Well, you know, a bunch of us get together and, you know, we have the power. The people have the power around here. And we forgot about that. We forgot that our public servants are just that. They're servants. We do not answer to them. They answer to us. They work for us. And if you don't see the police state forming around you, then, you know, you really got to go and check out Dan's website. You know, you got to keep listening to Survival and Beyond and keep up with all the news and information that we're putting up on survivalandbeyond.net, and as well as, like, everything else. You know, that this information is out there, and people are waking up in record numbers now. It's gratifying to see that more and more people are starting to become aware, and they're starting to take a look around them, and they ain't liking what they're seeing. Because this is not what America is about. You know, this is not the America that I grew up in, and it's not the America that Dan grew up in. But, yeah, I'm sure glad you're doing what you're doing, and I'm glad you came by and talked to us on this show, and I'm sure our listeners really appreciated it, and hopefully it inspired them to do something and not just talk about it or shrug their shoulders or just, you know, give up and go back to sleep. So thanks a lot for being on the show, Dan.
Yeah, no problem. And just as a final note, at Panda, we've spent the last 4 months kind of creating the McDonald's of the liberty fight. We figure that, you know, everything else is convenient. Why not fighting for liberty? Why can't we make this convenient? Why can't we make this something that it's easy for anyone to do? And we've set that up. So there's systems. We can take someone who knows nothing about the NDAA and take them and have their city pass legislation against it. So I'd want to really encourage people to join, go to the Join Us or the Get Involved page and submit a submission so we can get in touch with you, and no one in your area can get detained instead of just watching other people do it and then make the federal government able to run free in your own county.
Well, there you have it, folks. There's the information. Go to peopleagainstndaa.com and get active. More importantly, that's the most important thing. Get active, get out there, spread the information, and do something. If you don't want to be a slave, if you don't want your kids to be slaves, and you don't want the government just being able to haul you off for any reason and detain you indefinitely, This is straight out fascism, folks, and we've got to do something about it. And Dan, I'm glad you came on the show. I'm glad you're out there doing something about it. I'm glad you took the initiative to start Panda and open people's minds, wake people up to the tyranny that's going on in this country.
It was wonderful being on your show. I like the kind of things you've been alerting people about, so I thank you very much for your efforts as well in promoting the cause of liberty and the liberty movement itself.
Just doing whatever I can, Dan, but thanks. Well, we're going to take a quick break right now. When we come back, we're going to be speaking with our next guest, which is Mike Brown. Mike's a true Renaissance man. he manufactures steam engines, and he's also a law and constitutional scholar. And he's going to be coming back here, and he's going to tell us all about why you need a steam engine for survival and beyond. So got to work that pun in there. So just stick around. We'll be right back.
Do you know someone who can benefit from this radio program? You can find the complete archives of this show and hundreds of others at naturalnewsradio.com. Just send your friend that link, naturalnewsradio.com, where they will find truly amazing interviews and information that simply isn't published anywhere else. In the Natural News Radio archives, you'll find interviews with Dr. Andrew Wakefield, Senator Rand Paul, Governor Jesse Ventura, Suzanne Summers, alternative cancer doctors, nutrition experts, preparedness experts, and a wealth of others. And it's all free. Listen in real time at naturalnewsradio.com or download the MP3 archive files and listen on your phone or personal computer. And when you want articles on these topics, check out naturalnews.com with over 35,000 article pages on nutrition, natural cures, health freedom, and much more. It's all part of the Natural News Network. Thanks for listening. Have you ever wanted to learn where you can get free food and medicine from the plants growing around your neighborhood? Or how to turn your own backyard into a food production center? Or even how to reverse cancers using the latest groundbreaking research in alternative cancer therapies? You can learn all this and more from webseed.com. It's sort of like Netflix, but it's for documentaries and how-to courses on natural health, food production, self-reliance, and other life-saving topics. I'm Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, and I created Webseed so that listeners like you could get instant streaming access to truly groundbreaking instructional courses. Our new program called Vaccines Armed and Dangerous exposes the total fraud of modern vaccine quackery. And our Survival course teaches emergency preparedness, including skills like how to build your own emergency water filter. Explore over 100 valuable courses and documentaries right now at WEBSEED.com.
Hi, this is Mike Adams, the Health Ranger. In uncertain times, you need gear you can count on. That's why I teamed up with Daniel Vitalis to launch SupplySource.com. It's a new online retailer offering extremely durable gear for emergency preparedness and long-term survival. Everything we offer survives my daily use test on a ranch in Texas, plus Daniel's outdoor endurance test in the rugged wilderness of Maine. Most of the stuff we test ends up in a pile of trash because it breaks. The stuff that doesn't break, we stock it on SupplySource.com. To get the site started, we've launched it with a line of rugged, reliable, waterproof LED flashlights, now chosen by military and law enforcement everywhere. And we'll soon be adding a whole new brand of emergency water filters, family defense gear, and urban survival tools. When you want your gear to really work, get it from SupplySource.com.
And we're back, and you're listening to Survival and Beyond. I'm your host, Ed Corcoran, and we're hollering at you from the Natural News Radio Network, Prepper Podcast Radio Network. And starting this week, I'm happy to announce we're also going out to the Free America Now Network. And it's good to be getting out there and talking to all the good folks, spreading the word about survival and preparedness and all the stuff that you're not going to get from the mainstream lying machine. And don't forget to check out the main site, survivalandbeyond.net. And I'm always working on that site, adding new content, new downloads, survival guides, plus all the news and preparedness information, and again, you know, the stuff you need to know about your liberty that's under attack, folks. So that's survivalandbeyond.net, and check that out. There's a lot of great stuff up there. And our next guest on Survival and Beyond needs no introduction in the fields of alternative energy. He's very well known as being one of the last steam engine manufacturers on the planet. And the way that steam engines correlate to a survival type of scenario is very rarely talked about. A lot of people talk about generators and solar power and wind turbines and whatnot, but it's a very little known fact that steam engines are a very viable way of producing power in a grid down situation, in a collapse situation. And Mike is also a legal and constitutional scholar, and he's written books on the subject, the Bill of Rights Handbook, for example, and also in the Supreme Court of the United States, Why You Have No Civil Rights and What You Can Do About It, as well as other legal texts detailing how to deal with the legal system that we have here. So without any further delay, just let me welcome Mike Brown to the show. How you doing, Mike?
Pretty good, and thanks for having me, Ed.
It's always a pleasure to talk to you. And I really dig the idea of what you're doing, you know, with the steam engine thing, and I really want to get that out to our listeners because it's not really, you know, talked about a lot, like I mentioned. And you know, why do you've written an article for Survivalist Magazine called, you know, Steam Engine: Why You Need One? And why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about that? Why do we need the steam engine?
Well, as long as society is you know, basically going along smoothly, you don't. On the other hand, there's an old expression: in the land of the blind, the one-eyed man is king. And in a grid-down situation, and sometimes this has gone on for weeks, and we're not talking about a society that's collapsed. We're just talking about normal, everyday tornadoes, hurricanes, ice storms, that sort of thing. There were some people up in Maine, I think, here a while back that they went 3 weeks without power right in the middle of winter. Well, the beauty of a steam engine is that, number one, you're not going to run out of fuel. You can use anything that burns. You can use wood, fallen limbs, old newspapers, corn cobs, government documents, you name it. A steam engine will run on them. It's called a logistically independent fuel source. The problem with all other fuel sources is somebody has to refine them. And when you refine them and you store them in underground tanks, such as gasoline or diesel, well, when the power goes down, the power to the gas station goes down too.
Sure.
So there you are. You may have all that fuel, but it's not accessible. And even if it is, there's a finite amount of it. The one thing there is not a finite amount of is wood, cellulose, grass clippings, and that sort of thing. And that's what you run a steam engine on. And mm-hmm. if you have a standby system set up to run on steam, you have heat, power, and light, and you have a lot more of it than you have with solar or wind.
Right. Yeah, I've seen some of your engines on your site. And to our listeners, if you want to check out Mike's stuff, you can go to MikeBrownSolutions.com, and he's got all kinds of great information up on there. And, man, these steam engines, they look sleek. They look like you know, they're not out of place at all in as far as aesthetically in a modern sense, and it's really, you know, I think they're really cool, basically. And I don't know anything about how they work, what the maintenance is. I understand it's kind of high maintenance to keep a steam engine going, because you always have to have somebody fueling the fire, as it were.
Well, that's true, unless you've got an automated system. But when you talk about high maintenance, that's not exactly on point, because when you talk about maintenance, it's keeping the machinery running. When you're talking about feeding it, yeah, you're talking about throwing wood in the hang on a second. You're just talking about throwing wood in the furnace, and that's not exactly maintenance. That's just feeding the puppy. And
sure.
you can automate that if you want. It's kind of a big nuisance. But like we were discussing earlier off the air, if you have a situation in which you're freezing your butt off and you want to have heat, power, and light, well, then going out there and throwing a log on every 20 or 30 minutes really isn't that much of an inconvenience.
No. And the beauty of the heat and the steam engine is that you get heat directly from, you can heat your home from the heat that's generated by the steam engine as that's a pretty good bonus.
Well, that's true, because what you've got with a steam engine, now no steam engine is going to be more than like 10% efficient. Hang on a second again. But if you scavenge the exhaust heat, in other words, if the the steam coming out of the exhaust, it's still steam. It doesn't turn into water. That takes a condenser. But if you take that exhaust steam and you circulate it around the baseboards of your house or wherever you want, that efficiency of 10% goes up to close to 60 to 80%.
Mm-hmm. Now, with the steam engine, there's mechanical energy that you can utilize. You can also charge batteries and, you know, generate electricity with the steam engine. How exactly does that work?
Well, that's actually fairly simple and straightforward because there are a lot of people out there, they're already familiar with battery banks and inverters and all that sort of thing. Now, the beauty of a steam engine is that once you have the engine, if you can weld, you can build your own boiler. The rest of the parts normally come from the boneyard or the salvage yard, or they're just junk. For example, let's say you have a 3-horsepower steam engine. You want to produce about 1,500 watts, and in 4 hours, you want to store up 6 kilowatts. You simply get a General Motors truck alternator from the boneyard. You hook up a belt from the steam engine to the alternator. The alternator, in turn, charges a bank of batteries. You pull the DC power and convert it to AC, because you can't store AC, with an inverter. And, of course, you see all these fancy inverters, like it cost $800 and things like that. And you can get these surplus center inverters, war surplus, they're not very efficient. But nobody really cares how many miles to the twig they get. You may be looking at $80. And once you have that, then you wire it into your house. In fact, on the website, there's plans available on how to do this. Basically, what you now have is you have a complete system that will provide standby power. Now, it's not something you plug in like a toaster, because any steam system is going to have to be engineered if you're going to get maximum efficiency out of it. In other words, you have to decide what you're going to do with the exhaust steam. You know, some people just let it blow off into the atmosphere, kind of wasteful. But you can do all sorts of other interesting things, not only heating your home. You can make soap, run a distillery, all kinds of things you can do.
Yeah, it's amazing the versatility. And now, we had a previous conversation where you actually recommended a steam engine over a generator that would, you know, burn gasoline or, you know, petroleum, diesel or gas.
Well, that's true. In addition to the obvious problem of were you going to get fuel in a collapse situation, basically gas engines don't last very long. If you're going to run something 24/7 and it's a gas engine or even a diesel, it's not going to last the way a steam engine does. For example, and there's reasons for this, which we can get into if you want, but there's a steam engine in a locomotive in India, and it's been in constant daily service since 1855. There was a steam engine in the coal yard in Great Britain. They set it up around 1800. I think when they shut it down, they'd run out of coal. It was around 1950. There's a sugar mill in Brazil that their steam engine has been in constant service since 1877. In other words, the wear factor is just so far superior to anything else out there that there's no comparison.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I did want to clarify that. You know, people bring up all kinds of arguments when you talk about generators, and you say, well, you know, you're going to run out of petroleum eventually, and then people go, well, there's biodiesel. Well, you're going to run out of vegetable oil eventually, and, you know, just on and on down the line. I mean, it's at best a stopgap measure if you're thinking about a gas-powered or diesel-powered generator. And that's amazing that the wear and tear and everything, is it just basically the has fewer moving parts, and, you know, if you maintain it and everything, then it should run for centuries?
Well, it'll run for centuries if you lubricate it, and it's not because it has fewer parts much. It's just the entire method or the philosophy or whatever you want to call it, comparing a steam engine to a gas engine, is this. For example, I'm sure you've heard of spark knock.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's when you have carbon formation and it's causing fuel to ignite that wasn't lit off by the spark plug. Well, an engine can hammer itself to pieces like that. But you have that taking place on a microscopic level. Well, you'll never get spark knock in a steam engine because a steam engine will not form carbon inside the cylinder. There's
right.
There's no way for it to. One of the other things that you have with a steam engine is there's no side loading on the piston. In other words, when you have a regular internal combustion engine and that crankshaft is turning around, well, the piston is getting pressure on one side then on the other. But with a steam engine, it's uniform because between the cylinder and the crankcase, you have what's called a crosshead. And the crosshead changes linear motion into rotary motion. And so then, you know, now you have a crankshaft that rotates, but you don't have side loading on the piston. And as an aside here, you'll see all these people say, oh, well, I'm going to convert a gas engine to a steam engine. Lots of luck. Here's what's going to happen to you. You know, the first thing that's going to happen is that you don't have a crosshead, which means that the steam is going to get into your crankcase and turn into water. So, you know, who knows how long that's going to last. Then the other problem you're going to run into with a standard gas or diesel engine is you have what's called bearing crush. And in other words, have you ever driven like a car that it lugged down?
Lugged down.
Yeah, you know when the thing starts bucking on you when you're at real low RPM?
Uh-huh, yeah.
Okay, well, that's what you're doing when you have a gas engine converted to steam. I mean, you can do it, but, you know, it's not really advisable because what happens is that the bearings don't adjust to the crankshaft at higher RPM like they do with a, you know, standard gasoline-fueled engine. And so what winds up happening is the thing is just literally jerking all over the place when you try to get it operational. And, you know, they'll last for a while, but they're just not really a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you don't, the lubrication just isn't there. In other words, a gas engine, you've got to get it up about, say, 1,200 RPM to get it to lubricate properly. Well, a steam engine that's running properly is going to run at about 600 RPM, and you're not going to use the same type of bearings. You're going to have to use roller bearings instead of, you know, the standard automotive bearings. And there are people who do make steam engines with automotive parts, and the people that buy them, I've met some of them, they're just not really happy with them.
Now, there's a lot of different kits out there. Speaking of you know, that company that you just mentioned, the conversion kit. And are you the last actual manufacturer? You build complete steam engines. You're the last person basically in the world to do that, right?
Well, that would be possibly true of small piston steam engines. Let me qualify that.
Okay.
A steam turbine is actually a steam engine, and there are multi-million-dollar steam turbines, which we don't make, that have boilers that are 12 stories high, which we don't make. And if you're talking about turbines, no, there's quite a few. If you're talking about small piston steam engines, there's a difference between manufacturing them and making them one at a time. Now, there are people out there who make them one at a time. As far as I know, we're the only ones who do, like, you know, production runs of 10, 20, 30 at a time. And even then, it's difficult because what people don't relate to with steam engines, I mean, it's just like with, say, General Motors, they have a plant in Tonawanda, New York. It's got production lines, and each line spits out 800 small block Chevy engines an hour, and there's three lines like that. You can't build steam engines like that. The metal's too thick. There's too much machining involved. For example, to give you a little quick historical tidbit here, from the year 1800 till 1860, when they were using manual equipment, basically lathes, milling machines, things like that. The designs haven't changed, just the speed at which we can do things and CNC equipment and so forth. But in those years, there were only 2,000 steam engines made in the entire United States. We're talking about for locomotives, we're talking for steamboats, we're talking for power plants, for factories, the old factories, for example. If you wanted a factory run by a steam engine, you simply ran a belt from the engine up to a line shaft in the ceiling of the factory.
Sure.
And then you would have spaces in which other belts would go down to the machines that you wanted to drive.
Right. Here in New England, we still have a lot of old industrial buildings that are like that, where you can still see the apparatus is still in place with all the belts going everywhere.
Right. Yeah. That's it. Well, think about this for a minute. If you make 2,000 engines in a 60-year period, that's 34 engines a year in the entire United States.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's basically a tedious process. Plus, a lot of the people that are making them, pardon?
Well, yeah, I can imagine with manual tools.
Well, it's not just the manual tools. It's they make other mistakes. And I'm not going to mention any names here. People can basically look it up for themselves. But if you have a company that's making steam engines with automotive bearings on the crankshaft, well, you're going to have a problem.
Yeah.
If you have another company, if you're making the crosshead out of aluminum and you're making the piston inside of it out of aluminum, you're going to have galling, and that crosshead is going to last about 1% as long as it should.
Mm.
There's a lot of these people doing these things one at a time. They're making a lot of mistakes. In fact, it was kind of funny because the fellow who got us started, this is going back about 16 years ago, Skip Goble. Well, his father owned an outfit that sold blueprints and castings and so forth and so on. So when Skip came to us and said he wanted us to, build steam engines and so forth and so on, we said, well, what's wrong with the ones that your dad's doing? And he said, Brown, they only last about 45 minutes.
Really?
Now, his dad is really knowledgeable on steam, but he just, he had antique equipment. And, he just didn't have what he needed to build them properly. Now, see, most of your steam engine guys, they fall into two categories. One of them is they're working out of a garage, and they're looking to make millions, okay? And they think somebody's going to come along and discover them. And the other category is the guys sitting around in their railroad hats, okay, chewing. You think I'm kidding here, okay?
Oh, no, I know of whom you speak.
Okay?
Yeah.
And they're chewing tobacco and talking about the wreck of old 97.
Right.
All right? Now, you know what a killaloo bird is?
No.
Okay, well, these guys with the railroad hats are the functional equivalent of killaloo birds. And a killaloo bird flies backwards. And the reason it flies backwards is because it really doesn't care where it's going. It only wants to know where it's been.
Yeah.
So, and that's what you've got in this field. I'm surprised there aren't more people in it. But then again, and this is one of the things that I have to stress, is that Americans don't plan, they react.
Right.
In other words, if you have something that will benefit you in a fuel crunch or whatever, the odds are you're going to starve until the crunch actually gets here.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's lines around the block. Well, right now, we're kind of in between that. We sell steam engines actually faster than we can make them, but we're not making a whole lot of them.
You're not making a whole. How many do you make per year on average?
Oh, per year. Let's see. That would be, maybe 100.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, and that's not very much. When we were in the carburetor business, the fish carburetor, we were making 40 of them a week, which would have been okay. Except the problem was, we were selling 65 of them.
Hmm. So. How long does it take to build your typical, say, the most popular model? I know you make a couple different models.
We make three, actually. We make a one-horse, which is basically kind of an educational toy. We make a three-horse, which you can use to run just a medium-sized house, standby power. And we make a 20-horse that seems to be quite popular overseas. We sell more of them in places like, India, Thailand, Chile, Brazil, in places like that than we do here. But when you say how long it takes to make one, that's kind of hard to figure out, because what we do is we'll run a whole bunch of parts, and we don't run everything all at the same time. In other words, let's say we've got you know, we've got 50 different parts. Well, we don't just sit down and say, okay, we're going to make 20 steam engines. We're going to run 20 of each part. What we actually do is we just run them kind of haphazardly, and as we run out of parts, then we machine more parts and we assemble more engines. So the truth is, I couldn't tell you. The only thing I could give you an example of, so you'll understand how hard it is to make these things, we have CNC equipment. Our shop's about 15,000 square feet. We have 20 employees, about 16 pieces of CNC equipment. Now, the cylinder on the 3-horsepower alone requires 6 different operations on CNC equipment, each one of which takes 20 minutes. And on the 3-horse, there's 2 cylinders. So that'll give you an idea, even with modern equipment, even with CNC equipment, they're still real tedious and difficult to make.
So how much would it cost on average? I mean, if somebody would buy one of your, like, your 20 horsepower, what's the buy-in cost for to get into steam power as an alternative energy source?
All right, well, are you talking about somebody who's handy, who can weld, or are we talking about a housewife that wants something that's already put together?
Well, it's both of them.
Okay, well, if you're looking at a complete package, to where you have a 20 horsepower steam engine, you have the boiler, you have the generator, you know, you have the pumps. I mean, everything's set up to where basically what you have to do is fire it up, and that's all you have to do. You're probably looking around $25,000. On the other hand, you know, let's go to the other end of the spectrum. If you have a 3-horse, that's like $2,400 is what we sell them for. And if you can weld, you can put a boiler together because we send out the instructions with the engine for slightly under $1,000, and you can literally build a whole system for about $4,000, which I realize is a lot more expensive than your standard standby generator that runs on petroleum. But here's the difference: the system that you build, let's say with a 3-horse steam engine, is going to be there 10, 20, 30 years from now. That gasoline generator is going to burn up, if you run it consistently, in about 90 days.
Right.
You know, and that's if you're lucky.
Now, when it comes to generating electricity, now my assumption is, and correct me if I'm wrong, obviously the first thing that you would think about is storing electricity that's generated in batteries. But you could also run that direct, couldn't you?
Well, you could, but then you have to have a constant load. You're not going to have a constant load because during, let's say the daylight or in the evening, you're going to have so many things operating, your washing machine, your dryer, and that sort of thing. At 2 o'clock in the morning, you don't need any electricity.
Right.
Except maybe for your refrigerator, so you don't have a constant load. If you have a constant load, in other words, if you have something that's going to require so much power consistently, then you can run it direct.
Okay. Yeah, because I'm always thinking about, well, the batteries will only hold a charge for a finite period of time, and, you know, unless you can fabricate your own batteries, you know, there's a lot of things where it really pays, and I'm sure a lot of our listeners are handy. They're DIYers, you know, they're do-it-yourselfers and everything. There is a certain element of work that has to go involved if you want to do it economically and also for a very, you know, long-term situation.
Well, see, the difference is the batteries will last for years, and you can get some of these surplus batteries, like for forklifts, and those, I don't know how long they last, but I know it's a humongous amount of time. And plus, if you get, you know, if you really get in a collapse situation, if you go back about 100 years and look at the way batteries were built around 1912, they were basically just wooden boxes lined with metal, and you just slid the plates in.
Sure.
And then when the plates, you know, when one of them got too cluttered, the other one got too thin, you just took the plates out and just put 2 new plates in.
Yep.
So we don't do that anymore because it's so much easier to mass produce them. But if you actually wanted to have batteries that were going to last for generations, that's probably the way you'd have to do it.
Now, apart from the generation of electricity, what other applications or useful applications, I should say, that you can apply a steam engine to?
Anything you can use a gas engine for. You could drive automobiles with them. You could run boats. You could run irrigation engines. You can run water pumping plants. In other words, see, bear in mind that we had an infrastructure in the 19th century that was primarily steam-powered, and that's true even up until about, around 1920. They were still using really large piston steam engines to produce power. But boats, I'd say, would be one of the main ones, simply because in a collapse situation, the one method of transportation that does not depend on highways, waterways.
Right.
In other words, that's, in fact, initially, all your major cities, and it doesn't matter what you're talking about, London, Paris, New York, St. Louis, New Orleans, they're all on waterways.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We had Scott B. Williams, the author of Bug Out, on the show a couple weeks ago, and he's a big advocate of prepping for water escape, or because nobody ever talks about that. They'll talk about stealthy road vehicles or rugged road vehicles for off-road and everything, and you're going to eventually sooner or later you're going to run into a situation where either A, you can't go any further without traveling the waterways, or B, it's just a more expedient way to get out of Dodge if the highways are all clogged up and or they're cracking down and putting up roadblocks or whatever, So yeah, that's a very good point.
Well, I'm a little curious because I didn't hear the program. Obviously, I missed something. What was his recommendation for a power source for these boats?
Well, we were thinking more along the lines of like a bug out situation where you're just trying to get out of Dodge, and he's talking more about like kayaks or canoes or something, an expedient vehicle just to get out of the immediate area. As far as like long term, he does touch upon houseboats and other live aboard type boats that could be your bug out retreat if needs be. We didn't really talk too much about the power supplies or anything like that. And this is more about bug out tactics than the actual the power systems and whatnot.
Oh, okay, yeah, because I was kind of wondering because, I mean, I could understand people, going back to sails, but that's kind of a nuisance.
Well, actually, he did. He's a proponent of sailboats as well. He concedes, though, that the drawback of that is that you're highly visible, and well, if you don't want to be seen, the sailboat is pretty obvious.
yeah, well, especially the mast sticking up like that.
Right.
I was kind of curious because I had a psychic tell me that I should write a screenplay on the age of steam about how steam comes back into its own after society collapses or the end of the world as we know it or whatever. So I did. I had a lot of fun with it.
Mm-hmm.
I never actually got a nibble on it, but basically what I did was I lined out and said, okay, here's what happens. Here's where the guy with the steamboat now rules the Great Lakes.
Right. So. Yeah, that's an interesting scenario. So we looking at some survival fiction on the horizon from Mike Brown?
Well, I've already completed the screenplay. I've just, who knows, maybe one of your listeners, knows somebody in the movie business. Because the big mistake that Kevin Costner made with The Postman, there were no steam engines.
Yeah. Well, James Wesley Rawls' first book, Patriots, was originally written as a screenplay.
Really? Well, I read the book, and in fact, the guy that one of my dealers, Montana Steam Power, out in Montana, he's got a completely operational system. He insisted that I read the book, and he sent it to me. This is kind of entertaining. His whole thing was, I believe it was on an economic collapse.
Mm-hmm.
For these people with the money supply, who knows what rabbits they'll put out of a hat. But the other book, One Second After, I assume you've read that?
I've not read all of it.
Okay, well,
I don't have a whole lot of time for reading these.
Oh, I understand, yeah. Well, now, his scenario was an electromagnetic pulse. which we actually had in 1859, and it fried all the telegraph lines in the United States and Western Europe, but it didn't bother any of our industry because it was all powered by steam.
Right.
You know, and whereas you have all these transistors and everything else, it'll get fried with an electromagnetic pulse.
Mm-hmm.
Steam engine, just you can give it all the electromagnetic pulses you want. It'll just sit there and look at you.
Yeah.
It won't affect it a bit.
Yeah, I also don't think the solar energy as a viable solution, I don't think that's maturing fast enough, and it's not coming down to a and also the longevity of it, you know, just really isn't there.
Well, here's what they're not telling you about solar. Solar collects dust. Solar panels collect dust. Dust blocks sunlight. So what you have to do with solar panels to get maximum efficiency out of them, you have to wash them down every day. It takes less water to run a steam engine. And the other problem that you have with, well, yeah, it's expensive. Solar never pays for itself. I mean, it's just,
no.
I'll give you an example. I had a guy call me from Alaska. Now, I had written this article, and it was just a whimsical thing about, okay, what would happen if electricity, instead of 10 or 15 cents a kilowatt, was a dollar? Now, you would have a 20-horsepower steam engine would produce about 15 kilowatts, so now you've got $15 an hour that this machine is making you. Okay, this is viable. You do this 24/7. You're making a nice chunk of change. And I'm thinking, okay, this isn't going to happen unless, you know, these power stations start taking a dump. And about 2 days after I finished writing this article, guy calls me from eastern Alaska. He's way out in the boonies. And he's paying 80 cents a kilowatt for electricity because it has to be produced by diesel generators. And the diesel fuel they were getting up from Anchorage was like $9 a gallon.
Jeez.
So there it was. I thought, okay, so my concept is viable. It's just the problem is it's only viable in eastern Alaska in these remote villages.
Yeah. So. No, I do think it's viable. I mean, you know, it doesn't seem like you can really go wrong. And if you have the skills, or you know somebody who has the skills, and you said what, $4,000 if you know how to weld and, you know, set everything
right
up yourself.
Yeah, I mean, that's true. The thing is, see, here's the beauty of a steam system. You can actually learn how to operate a steam system in about 2 days. In other words, if you have, let's say you have a class and people really want to learn how to run a system, you can teach them pretty much everything they need to know in 2 days. Now, when it comes to making steam engines, and this is where a lot of people get confused, you can teach somebody, and the reason I'm talking about making as opposed to using is my favorite line in One Second After is on page 176, where the hero of the book turns to his compadre and says, they're sorting through these refugees to see who they can use, where he says, I'd kill to get somebody who knew how to build or operate a steam engine.
Well, yeah.
You can learn to operate it in 2 days, but to learn to build one, it takes 10 years to train a decent machinist.
Mm.
So.
Now, one other thing, and I know you've got a lot to say about this, is some people are concerned about the safety of steam engines. You know, people are afraid that, oh, they're going to blow up if there's too much pressure and whatnot. What do you have to say about that?
Well, it depends on what you've got. If you have a decently operating system that's been, you know, the boiler is what blows up, all right? If you have a system that's been maintained properly, nowadays it takes some real talent to blow one up. I'll give you an example. I'm sure most of your listeners remember the disaster in Medina, Ohio over 10 years ago. Kay's steam tractor blew up, killed 5 people, and maimed another 47. Well, here's what didn't make the news. In the first place, a friend of mine, who's a boilermaker, he inspected this thing 2 years before. And it was a Kay steam tractor. A guy in Pennsylvania owned it. And he told the guy, he said, this boiler is, you know, he says, it's condemned. He said, you know, this thing, you know, don't fire this up. And go, oh, no, you just want to sell me a new boiler. And my buddy said, no. He said, this thing is dangerous. Well, then when he found out it was going to these fairgrounds, in Ohio, he called, my guy called these people up and said, hey, you know, don't let that thing within 100 miles of your show. It's dangerous, okay?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't listen. They told him to F off, all right? So the thing shows up there, okay, and predictably, it blows up, okay? Now, when I was at the Pawnee Steam School here about 3 years ago, I met the guy the sheriff's department hired to find out why this thing blew up, because normally, like I said, it takes some real talent to blow one of these things up. Well, what you have right above the furnace, you have a thing called a crown sheet. And the crown sheet is what separates the fire from the water. And there's a thing about the size of a spark plug. It's called a fusible plug. And the way it's designed is it's got a zinc core. And when the boiler gets too hot, when the water gets too hot, the zinc core melts out, and then the water spills down onto the fire and puts the fire out. Mm. Well, there was another tractor there in Ohio the same year in Ohio that the fusible plug worked properly. The thing got too hot, fusible plug, the zinc let go, put the fire out, no harm done. Well, when the guy from was hired by the sheriff's department got to inspecting it, you know, he had like this airplane hangar with all the parts and everything, and he got it down to the fusible plug, and he said, okay, here's why this thing blew up. This guy had left the fusible plug in so long that the zinc in the fusible plug had turned to zinc oxide. Mm. Well, zinc melts out at 450 degrees, but zinc oxide doesn't melt until you hit 2,900 degrees.
Oh, geez.
And I mean, a little $10 part would have you know, kept that thing from blowing up.
Hmm.
But now, prior to the government getting involved, I mean, you're talking between 1820 and 1840. Oh, yeah, these things were blowing up left and right. Okay. And part of the problem is that all the way up till the end of the 19th century, most of the people who owned these things, for some reason, thought it didn't take any intelligence to run a boiler, so they normally put the dumbest person on the crew in charge of the boiler, which wasn't real good business. And all the way up until, I think, around 1920, they were still having regular explosions. And then you'd have, steam tractors. You know, you'd have farmers that would have these things. Well, whenever you have a tractor with a horizontal boiler going up and down hills, well, then the water sometimes doesn't get where it's supposed to. And when steel gets to the temperature of 800 degrees, it has all the strength of cardboard.
Mm.
But, you know, nowadays you get a vertical fire tube boiler, and if everything's working the way it's supposed to and you're just halfway paying attention, well, you'd have to work at it to blow it up.
Right. And just make sure you check that zinc plug every...
You replace it every couple of years.
Every couple of years, replace it every couple of years.
Yeah, or some people replace them every year. Yeah, because that one piece of equipment, the fusible plug, I don't know who invented it or when, but it has saved more lives than anything else out there having to do with steam. And it's just a little piece of equipment the size of a spark plug.
Well, it's really exciting to me. I mean,
well, it gets better. Yeah, there's this Montana Steam Power. I mean, this guy's a go-getter. I mean, in fact, I've got he may take our entire production run of 3-horsepower steam engines next week. I mean, the way this guy goes. But what he did was he came up with the idea of doing a prefabricated boiler where you don't have to weld it. You basically just screw it together.
Huh.
And if he succeeds, which I think he's going to, then that, you know, that basically opens up a whole new world for people who want to just have a system that they can stuff in a closet till they need it.
So can people go on your website and just order a steam engine from you, or how would they go about that?
Well, I would rather they didn't try that in the first place. Okay, we're normally 2 months back-ordered.
Uh-huh.
We don't do credit cards on the website, but what they really need to do, I mean, if you've got somebody who's really serious about getting into steam, the first olive out of the jar is to get what we call our special steam package, and that's the manual assembly, disassembly. She teaches people the different types of boilers, valving systems, that sort of thing. In other words, teaches them the basics, teaches them how to assemble and disassemble and troubleshoot our 3-horsepower steam engine. Got a set of machinist prints that shows them where all the steam passages are, what each passage looks like, so forth and so on. A DVD. You still there?
Yep.
Okay. A DVD on how to build your own boiler with a parts list. And then there's another DVD that shows you how to set up an entire system. And what we do is we sell it as a package. We call it the special steam package. And then if somebody gets into it and gets his education, does his homework, gets an idea of what it is he's getting into, then if they later order a steam engine, we take the price of the steam package off the price of the engine. But that's really Wow. where people need to start. They need to start with their basic education.
Sure.
You know, they need to learn what they're getting into because, I mean, some people look at it and say, yeah, you know, there's nothing to this. I was looking at it, you know, I thought this was like plugging in the toaster. I think I'll pass.
Yeah, it's not exactly a snap-together model or a kit where they can just throw it all together, turn a few screws, and be done.
No, you have to think about what you're doing, and, of course, that lets a lot of the population out.
Well,
not your listeners, of course.
Oh, of course, not our listeners. No, our listeners are the smartest and most erudite folks that I know.
Okay.
And I'm sure that they're really getting jazzed about this. I mean, I'm glad you came on to share this with our listeners.
I'd like to leave you with an idea here.
Sure.
You know, your guy that did the thing about bugging out the kayak and all that?
Mm-hmm.
Kill two birds with one stone. Put a steam launch together, charge tourists for rides, and then when it's time to bug out, leave the tourists behind. You've got an operational steam launch. It's made you a lot of money in the meantime.
Right. That's a good idea. You're always thinking, Mike.
Mm-hmm.
So we do have a few minutes left, and another thing that I like to have on this show is people who are activists and people who are actually doing things to educate people or make people aware of the state of our freedom and our liberties in this country. And I just wanted to address a little bit of that about your Bill of Rights handbook and what you tell our listeners about that in the few minutes we have left, as well as your other books.
Oh, sure. Well, where would you like to go?
Well, I'll start with the Bill of Rights handbook.
Okay. Basically, I wrote that to replace or supplement or whatever you want to call it, the Citizens Rule Book. That's the one on jury nullification. Mm-hmm. Well, that particular booklet only covers jury nullification, does a fairly good job of it. Most of the book is quotations from a dissenting opinion by a judge named Bazelon. Dissenting opinions aren't law. And I'm thinking, okay, this guy's done a really good job. In fact, I think they've sold about 55 million copies of that book or booklet. But he's ignored the other 9 amendments to the Constitution and the other 4 sections of the 6th Amendment. So what I did, and for whatever it's worth, I do wear a couple of hats. I'm the senior paralegal for a law firm here in Springfield. And so I figured, okay, what we need to do is we need to show people what's actually going on, what the judiciary has done to the Bill of Rights. So they basically watered it down to the point of no return and then show people what they need to do about it. For whatever it's worth, I've been manufacturing steam engines for 16 years, but I've been literally engaged in litigation for 38 years. I've won a lot of cases. My specialty is breaking indictments, getting people out of prison, that sort of thing. So there's, the sad part of it is that, here's something that a lot of people need to understand, and I got this from a gal, she's a friend of mine, who is the head of, basically, she's a head administrator for a law office. And what she told me was, she said, Mike, she said, I have to write hurt on these attorneys. She said, and this is true of all of them, not just in her office, 60% of them are incompetent. 80% of them are lazy. So if you subsume the 60% within the 80%, that means that 20% of the lawyers out there actually know what they're doing and are willing to do the work, which means when the person on the street, the average person on the street, goes to hire a lawyer, their odds of getting one who knows what he's doing, who will actually do the work, are only 1 in 5.
Oh, yeah, the whole system is rigged. From the moment you walk in, you know, you haven't got a chance. We grew up thinking that, you know, everybody has their day in court and jury of your peers and, you know, innocent until proven guilty and justice prevails and all that. But, you know, it's a fantasy. But, you know, I'd really like to have you back on the show. I don't think I ever realized how extensive your background is in the legal system and what your experience has been.
Well, for whatever it's worth, I've worked on some fairly big cases. I'm sure you've heard of Imelda Marcos.
Mm-hmm.
I worked on her case. I worked on Falwell versus Hustler.
Really?
In fact, that's a whole story in itself. On when I got done with Jerry Falwell, he was expecting $10 million, which is what the last people got. I got it down to $300,000, which, of course, Hustler, they're such a bunch of scumbags anyway. I should have been working for him in the first place. No, if you go to Brown's Legal Research, you'll see some of the books I've written on the legal system.
Oh.
Just brownslegalresearch.com, and I've been writing books on the legal system since 1980. And what I try to do is the first thing that I'll teach somebody in a legal seminar, tell them, okay, all you got is three things, facts, law, and procedure, okay? Facts are what happened, law, that's an indexing system like you learned in the Dewey Decimal System in fourth grade. Procedure is how you move it through the court system. And you can literally teach somebody how to litigate, how to fight their own case in 2 days. In fact, one of the gals I taught out in Colorado a number of years ago, I trained, you know, she was just there with 102 other people, and she actually got a case to the United States Supreme Court for a guy named James Harrington. He'd done 25 years for a murder he didn't commit. And just before they were going to have an oral argument, the state of Iowa folded and gave him $7 million for his 25 years. I mean, you can actually beat these people, and a lot of times you're better off doing it yourself once you learn it, because you're not going to sell yourself out. And, you know, a lot of people suspect, oh, my lawyer sold me out. Well, of course they do. They do it all the time.
Sure, sure. So where can people go to get those books?
BrownsLegalResearch.com. Gallup in St. Charles, Missouri runs that one. I don't deal directly with the public on the legal system, because what winds up happening, somebody buys a book and then they get a hold of me and they think I'm supposed to give them 2 or 3 hours of my time because they bought my book and they read half of it.
Right. And they want you to tell them the other half.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
You know, so I try to avoid that. Now, they want to talk steam or bodybuilding or something like that. Yeah, I'm all ears. But as far as the legal system goes, you know, what we have in this country really isn't a court system. It's more of a legal casino.
Right.
You pay your money, you take your chances, and most of the time you lose your shirt.
Mm-hmm. It's all about feeding the machine. It's all about keeping that revenue flowing.
Yeah, 80 million lawsuits filed in the United States every year. We have 2.5 million people in prison.
Mm-hmm. 750,000 of them for victimless crimes or, you know, nonviolent crimes.
Actually, it's most of them are for nonviolent crimes. Just like in the federal system, I think you've got about 250,000 people, and I think like 2/3 of them are there for drug crimes that Congress never had the authority to enact in the first place. And my proof of that one is this. We had an amendment to the Constitution to outlaw ethyl alcohol, prohibition.
Yep.
Okay? Alcohol is a drug. It's just not a list of controlled substances. Now, my question to you is, where's the constitutional amendment to outlaw narcotic drugs?
Yeah, there is none.
But precisely, and it's in that book I sent you, Defending a Drug Case.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this whole legal system, it's basically, you know, it's run for the benefit of those who administer it, and woe betide you if you get caught up in it, because the judges, the prosecutors, even your own lawyer, they don't really care if you're innocent or not.
Right.
And they don't care if you lose everything you own or not.
Mm-hmm.
And there's ways to prevent that.
Yeah, and also the prison systems are all privatized. They're all built, staffed, maintained by contractors, and they just keep building more of them. You know, it's a big burgeoning business here in the land of the free.
Well, yeah, they have. There's a gal getting out of prison here. She's a friend of mine, Mikhail Kelly. You might want to have her on. She can tell you some of the horror stories about the Missouri women's prisons.
Oh, boy.
I mean, they're feeding these gals stuff that says not for human consumption.
Mm-hmm.
They're having male guards telling these girls, oh, you need a girlfriend, and oh, yeah, and I'll make sure nobody interrupts because I want to watch.
Yeah.
And then, of course, they're copping fields left and right. I mean, what they don't know right at the moment is the attorney that I work for is getting ready to light up the entire DOC and the Department of Corrections in this state.
Really?
Yeah. There's just, you know, so many indignities you can put people through before somebody at some point takes you to court. And there's ways, in fact, one of the things we probably will need to get into at some point, there's ways you can win a court case legally by going outside the court system. I beat John Ashcroft a few years back in a lawsuit I had. I lost it in four federal courts over a three-year period. I beat him in 6 weeks in Congressman Roy Blunt's office, because the highest legal authority in the United States, not the Supreme Court, it's the Congress. And I can prove it. But we should probably leave that for another day.
Yeah, unfortunately, that's about all the time we have left for this installment of Survival and Beyond. And I'd like to thank my guests, Dan Johnson, who spearheaded the group PANDA, People Against NDAA, and is growing with leaps and bounds, and it's really gaining momentum. So you're going to want to check that out at peopleagainstndaa.com. And also I'd like to thank Mike Brown, steam engine wizard, and he knows even more about the legal system, a hell of a lot more, and definitely going to have him back on the show to talk more about that and give that topic the time it deserves. And I'd also like to thank you folks for listening, and don't forget to check out survivalandbeyond.net. Got new stuff going up there daily. And hey, if you like Survival and Beyond, come on over to our Facebook page at facebook.com/survivalandbeyond and like that as well. And follow me on Twitter. I always forget to mention Twitter. My Twitter name there is Survival Beyond. So I guess that'd be twitter.com/survivalbeyond without the and. Oh, yeah, and one other thing. I promised Jerry Donaldson that I'd give him a plug for his show, and it's more than just a plug. I mean, I'm really endorsing his show. I really dig his show, and I was – some of you might remember I was on his show not too long ago. And so, yeah, go and check out. It's called Our Constitution, Foundation, and Principles, and that's on Blog Talk on the Free America Now Network. And for those of you who might be unfamiliar, if you're unfamiliar with National News, go and check them out, or Prepper Podcast, go and check those guys out. And definitely check out Jerry Donaldson's show. He's got it backwards and forwards and upside down when it comes to the Constitution, the Bill of Rights. So anyway, until next week, folks, as usual, keep your head up and keep on living free.